Hello, I'm Kerry Lunigan. Welcome to the Weekly Grill. It's brought to you by Beef Central and Elanco Animal Health. My guest for this episode has had a major influence in big, big jobs across the entire beef sector. His latest gig is as important as any in the industry. And welcome to the chair of the Red Meat Advisory Council, John McKillop.
Thanks, Kerry. Nice to have a chat to you.
John, we'll make our way to Armex soon, but first, your first interest in the rural sector. You're a boy from the bush, I assume. Tell us about your start in schooling and where you got your intrinsic interest in being in the agricultural sector.
Yeah, I was born and raised on a family farm at Nevertire, which is northwest New South Wales or central west New South Wales, depending your terminology. I'd always intended to go back on the family farm, and despite been accepted into uni, I decided to go and go to Ag College, which I did. And
which one is that, John?
To Orange Agricultural College.
All right, okay.
And then I suppose I stayed in that pathway for a number of years afterwards, and then probably at 27 realised that really the family farm was too small. You might recall that interest rates were around the 17, 18, 19%.
Yeah.
It was a fairly negative time in the industry, and so I decided that I was not going to take that chance and try and buy four siblings out, and so I would go out in the wide world and make my own way. So I went back at the uni and studied for the next 11 years, and meanwhile working in consulting, and actually first as a rural financial counsellor, and then in consulting. But then my real passion was always in this, I suppose, a fascination with the corporate space and scale and large properties and that whole world, and I'd always had a desire to move into that space, and that was fulfilled when I joined Stanbroke in 2002 up in Brisbane.
Can I mention some of the other companies you've been involved in? You'll fill in some gaps here. CBRE, of course, and there was a big company with owners from the Middle East, I understand.
Yes, last executive role was CEO of Hassad Australia, which was owned by the Qatar Investment Authority. We divested that about 3 years ago, a bit over $500 million, primarily to Macquarie, but a number of family operators as well, the Zells up at Cunnamulla, as well as the McBrides in South Australia. So, a number of different operators, but yeah, primarily to Macquarie in the end.
I just want to point out,
Kerry, that was actually the third time the company I worked for had been sold. Stanbroke has been going 38 years, and 2 years after I joined, it was put up for sale. And I joined Clyde Agriculture, it had been going 18 years, and 2 years after I joined, it was sold. And then Hassad was only 8 years. So I decided that I'm probably better off not to do executive roles in the corporate ag space anymore.
I'm sorry for laughing, John, but I spoke to an old mate who said you were constantly being asked to sell yourself out of a job, and that went across several companies.
It's hard not to take it personally after a while, Kerry.
So, Armec, when or if did you ever see yourself in the agri-lobbyist arena?
I had a little bit of interest in it. So I chair a group called the Corporate Ag Group, which is it's been going for about 12, 13 years now. And that's made up of, at the moment, about 9 or 10 of the larger corporate investors, tend to be not the northern pastoral ones, but the southern investors. And obviously, being in corporate, you know, the number of members and the members themselves come and go. And through that, we took out NFF membership back when David Crombie restructured the NFF to allow corporate members in there. So it had an interest in it, sat on the economics or chaired the economics committee for the National Farmers Federation. But certainly agri-politics wasn't in my space. And no one does agri-politics quite like the red meat industry. So when someone asked me if I was interested in it, my initial reaction was, no, it's probably not for me. I thought about it and thought, well, you know, if I can contribute, then I'd like to do so. So threw my hat in the ring and was fortunate enough to be given the gig.
So give us, John, a word picture of your mission statement for your term at Armec.
So Armec's role is primarily to be a link or a conduit through to the minister about policy. And it represents obviously the cattle council, sheep producers, feedlotters, the live trade, the processors and the goats. We also look after the Red Meat Industry Fund, which is about $42 million, and that disperses that across those peak industry councils every year to help them with their to meet their budgets. So we do that. And then really the primary role is to address issues that affect the whole of the supply chain. So if there's an issue there that's just only for the beef industry, then that would be Cattle Council. If it's an issue just for the processors, then that would be, you know, obviously with AMIC. But where there's an issue such as plant-based truth in labelling, which affects everyone in the supply chain, then that's where AMAC comes in and works with that, works across the whole sector to address those issues.
John, we'll get to plant-based issues later on, but are we heading for a big AMAC as proposed by many, or a low-key AMAC with a specific target here and there?
AMAC is a is governed by the MOU, and the MOU, the parties to the MOU are, amongst others, the PICS as well as the Commonwealth. So really, we're think of us almost as a member organisation. So we respond to what the members require of us to do. And at the moment, the members are very happy for us to be, well, I won't say low profile, but to address those issues, but not to become a mega organisation. You know, our total spend is about $400,000 a year. And we try and stick within that. You know, we only have one staff member and we have one part-timer and myself. So it's a very small budget and we try and make as big an impact with that small budget as we can.
John, AMAC has spent a lot of time, at least, I guess, talking about industry restructuring. There doesn't appear to be any pace or movement in this. Is this process dead in the water, or is change still on the agenda?
Yeah, a lot of work was done. Again, it was prior to my time. And coming up with what was called NUCO 1, NUCO 2, NUCO 3. The NUCO 1, which was the largest sort of organisation, it wasn't really about making AMAC the centre. It was just making one organisation a much larger organisation. I think people sort of took that as meaning that was AMAC, but you can give it whatever name you want and whatever board you wanted. The concept was to try and have a whole of industry approach to it. That doesn't seem to be going anywhere. Doesn't seem to be the appetite for it, which is probably disappointing because there was a lot of work done and a lot of good work done. Sometimes good messages get lost with, you know, bad delivery. I'm not saying this is necessarily a bad delivery, but it was people felt they weren't included, weren't consulted. But, you know, and that's it's always a difficult thing to overcome when people feel they weren't included. And it's also difficult to go out and in reality and consult with, you know, 42,000 beef producers. You've only got to leave some out and they feel that they were excluded. So there's not the appetite for that. NUCO 3 is probably the only one that we're still working on, which is a new model between AusMeat and Integrity Systems and how that might work. And MLA has been very good working with the industry on that and how that might look in the future. Reluctant to call it NUCO 3, but essentially that's what it is, which is an integration of those services. Or at least working out how those services work together.
John, I guess producers are too busy making money and processors are too busy trying to save money at present to worry about industry restructuring.
Yes, look, I'm always amazed that people who are very busy and are paid to do these things are prepared to give up their time and, you know, for the sake of the industry. You know, the Terry Nolans, the Gary Hardwicks, et cetera, that just... you know, that give up their time to do all these things and for the betterment of the industry. But you're right, it's a very, very good time to be a beef producer. Probably not the best time to be a processor. But as we know, in this industry, it swings and roundabouts all the time.
Is there any way to stop those swings and roundabouts? Is there any way to even out the industry so no one suffers terribly at any one time, which appears to be the case in recent times?
Well, it's probably been, you know, that case, you know, since I've been involved in, I'd say, 20-odd years, that it seems to be either one making money or the other making money, or if they're both making money, it's only at a point in time on the way back to one of those swings. In America, it's where they're 80-odd percent grain-fed, it tends to smooth that out a bit more because you have that constant supply, and therefore you're not subjected to the weather. In Australia, where we're about 50% grain fed, or just approaching that sort of percentage, I think we're always going to have this issue of seasonality. You know, if there's big rains across Australia and there's plenty of grass, supply dries up, and then processors are losing, and then you have a drought and you see 11 million cattle slaughtered, and you know, the processors, you know, are in the other foot and they're making good money and the producers aren't making as much, so or in some cases losing it, obviously. Yes. So I don't know what the solution is. People have talked about, you know, forward pricing and as a mechanism, but yeah, that's been tried a number of times in the beef sector and it's never really taken off. But you know, maybe another iteration of that could help smooth it out, but it's never going to really stop that seasonality around seasonal conditions.
We'll just pause for a moment on speaking with John McKillop. He's chair of the Red Meat Advisory Council. A message from our sponsors, Elanco Animal Health, and we'll be back in a minute.
Acatac Duo Star from Elanco provides knockdown and residual control of cattle ticks and ivermectin-sensitive parasites. Applied early in the season, Acatac Duo Star reduces the buildup of the tick population and helps to prolong the life of effective chemistry. Give ticks and worms the flick with Acatac Duo Star. Always read and follow the label directions and ensure good agricultural practice for optimal parasite control.
And welcome back. I'm speaking with John McKillop. He's chairman of Australia's Red Meat Advisory Council. John, it's a really odd situation now where we've got American processors making $800 a head and we've got Australian processors losing $350 a head. Is there any explanation for that?
Yeah. Again, I think it comes down to this issue of seasonality. You know, if you have a good season across Australia, or good seasons across Australia, cattle producers hold cattle back to breed up or grow out, and we drop down in numbers of slaughter. The US tends to be smoothed out by that lot fed situation and less prone to the seasonality of it. I don't think we're going to move away from that.
No, it's an odd one, isn't it? Now, getting to one of my favourite subjects, the fake meat business. It's probably started with fake milk, but it's recent times fake meat is all the go, it seems. I know the opinion is shared by many in the industry. What is AMAC going to do about it?
So I'm going to go back a little bit in history as to how this whole thing developed. FSANS, which is Food Standards Australia New Zealand, was very clear about what meat was. And actually, this clause is still in there. And it's something along the lines of meat is the flesh of of the carcass of a slaughtered animal or blah, 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 blah. And similar to milk, it describes it as, you know, the secretions of a lactating animal, blah, blah, blah. About 3 years ago, an additional clause was added into the FSANS standards that said, where a precursor describes it as being of another origin, it's okay to use that descriptor. In other words, as long as you say it's plant-based, you can call it beef. As long as you say it's plant-based, you can call it milk. So you can say, you know, we are plant-based chicken or we are soy milk. And our understanding is that was under a fair bit of lobbying pressure from Sanitarium with the intention of having milk included in their labelling. Because what it did was also open the floodgates for fake meat to be included in that labelling as well. And the plant-based manufacturers have made it very clear that their target market isn't the vegan market, because they've already got that market. What they're trying to target is the people who may become more flexitarian, as they call it. So hence it's in the meat cabinet. So rocking up and deciding to buy a plant-based patty rather than a pure beef product. So that's been their campaign. And how they've got around it is this addition of that clause into the FSANS standards. Oddly enough, Kerry, you can't export it as plant-based beef or plant-based chicken. You're only allowed to dupe the domestic consumers, not the international consumers.
I think it's one of the main bones of contention is, from the industry point of view, is that they have products that say chicken-free chicken or meat-free steak and things like this, is for damning the product as if it's bad, and yet using the name on their plant-based product. It's odd to me, but it's it's condemning one side, but what encouraging you to eat their product.
And that's the issue for us, is that we're not anti-competition. As long as everyone's able to compete on the same basis. But the marketing campaign of many of the plant-based manufacturers, not all of them, is to denigrate one product to raise their own product. And really saying that, you know, if you buy plant-based beef, it's not only better for you, it's better for the environment, it's better for animal welfare. You can buy this product being guilt-free. You know, whereas we have, you know, I've been involved in some fairly large cropping operations, and I can tell you there's no such thing as a free lunch in cropping either. You know, we don't leave too many trees standing. We don't leave any pests around. We spray every insect we can find, and, you know, we use a lot of chemical. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. If we want cheap food, that's what we have to do. Whereas the plant-based manufacturers, you know, sort of tend to ignore all that and just say, well, you know, you're not subject to methane, you're not contributing to animal welfare issues. But as we know in Australia, we actually lead the world in animal welfare practices, and the industry has a clear target and looking to achieve it to be carbon neutral by 2030. So it really removes all of those arguments that the plant-based manufacturers can put up.
Yes, but banning the use of the word meat on products which are clearly not meat, it's been done in Europe and France, and it's also being done in many American states. Why can't we do it here?
It really comes down to political will. So we've been very fortunate to have Susan McDonald, Senator Susan McDonald from Queensland, on our case for this, as well as the Minister for Agriculture, Dave Littleproud's been supportive as well, as have many of the politicians. Actually, I've got to say on both sides of the House have been very supportive of this. So Senator McDonald is holding a Senate inquiry into truth and labelling on plant-based products. That's kicking off at the moment. Submissions, we would encourage everyone to put in a submission if they can, because there's certainly plenty coming in from the plant-based sides. We need more from the meat side, the red meat sector in particular. And so what we're hoping to come out of that would be, first and foremost, is to remove that clause within the FSANS standards that allows them to use the descriptor of beef or lamb or goat or whatever it is. And then ideally, if we could, we would also like to have legislation or regulation in there similar to what Michael McCormick introduced for the free-range eggs, where there was a national standard adopted which required the consent of all states. But what it did for the consumer was allow them to say, well, if I'm buying this free-range eggs, it actually means something, and this is the standard that everyone has to adhere to. So that would be the two steps that we'd like to see done in order to get to remove that ability of the plant-based manufacturers to put a photo of a beef, cow or a steer or a lamb or a goat into there, as well as use the words.
Now, John, another disturbing issue which is emerging fast, I suspect, banks, John, and other lenders, I have to add, there's clearly a push for some banks and even insurance companies not to lend or have anything to do with sectors of agriculture because pressure is coming from anti-live exporters and anti-intensive farming activists. What are you doing about this?
Yeah, but again, you seem to be under attack from many different sources, but you know, if you delve back, most of them actually come from the likes of PETA and Animals Australia, where they're looking to, you know, not just remove red meat, they're actually really looking to remove livestock farming altogether. So what we're doing on that front is we've launched a campaign and we've put in a complaint to the ACCC against Bank Australia. Bank Australia is a small bank with 14 branches in Australia. Oddly enough, came out of the CSIRO Building Society and has merged with many others. It enjoys the privilege of having its deposits guaranteed by us, the taxpayer, but openly campaign, and if you see the ads on SBS, they're quite confronting, where they say, well, we don't lend to unethical industries like the live trade, so they're or intensive animal industries. If you actually go onto their website, you'll see that they list intensive animal practices such as dehorning, Now, you know, I've been involved in this industry a while, and you don't have to be in intensive agriculture to dehorn your cattle. And of course, they don't understand the effect of bruising and cuts if you don't dehorn. So there's a whole lot of, there's a whole lot of misunderstanding out there about what the industry does and how it does it and why it does it. And they're sort of using this to carve out a niche market, and I've got no objection to that. They're entitled to work out what their consumer base or their client base should look like. But then they shouldn't also enjoy the privilege of having a taxpayer-funded guarantee around their deposits.
Good point. That's the bad news. The banks the producers under attack from bankers and insurance companies. But the good news is I can't remember more positive vibes about the beef industry than right now and coming from the last 12 months.
That's a fantastic time for the industry. And as someone said to me yesterday, it's a good time to own a cow. And I think that that sums it up. The feeling of beef week, you know, was incredible. It was a very upbeat, you know, vibrant feel up there. You can feel that there's money in the industry and people are enjoying that. But I'm just make the comment to someone else. I think it even goes beyond that. It's just the fact that there's money in it. I just feel there's been this quantum shift, particularly in the northern pastoral industry now, where this next generation's coming through and they are very progressive. They're looking at technology. They're looking at breeding. They're running this. You know, they've moved beyond just the harvest model, and they're actually looking at running great businesses and how to innovate and how to get involved with the consumer. And it just seems to be a lot more energy in the industry from this next generation that's coming through. And I think it's a great thing for the industry because it'll set it up for many generations to come.
I've got one impossible question for you. Processors and live exporters, how are you going to get them in the same room together?
It's interesting because obviously in ARMAC we have the processors and the feedlotters and of course the live trade. And when I first took this board role on, they said a number of people said to me, "Oh well, you know that it's everyone's just fighting. You know, there's a whole lot of antagonism in the board." I've got to say that's just not the truth. You know, reality is that the board works really well together. I don't get the feeling from anyone on the ARMAC board. In the processing side, being naturally Terry and Gary, that there's any animosity towards the live trade. Everyone's got to coexist together. And in the same from the live trade, there's no animosity towards the processes. So, yeah, I think I just don't see it as an issue at this stage. I mean, I know that in the past there has been probably a few things said and a few things done that shouldn't have been done. But I feel that the industry's moved beyond that now, where it's just seen as one industry with different outlets.
John McKillop, I'm sorry we can't catch up at the Echo for a beer and another chat for obvious reasons, but thank you for appearing on The Grill.
Great. Thanks, Kerry. Good to chat to you. See you.
And thank you for joining me today. Until next time, I'm Kerry Lonigan, and this is The Weekly Grill, brought to you by Beef Central and our podcast partner, Elanco Animal Health.